Before the break and before the Lord's Supper, which is the reason we're here, and I appreciate very much the way Paul handled that, bringing us back to the thought that the Lord's Supper covers past, present, and future. We were talking about the book of Deuteronomy earlier, and we've gotten to the place where we're talking about the attitudes that Moses was trying to inculcate in the people of God as they stood on the brink of their conquest of the land of Canaan. And we were talking about this attitude of reverence. We had just started talking about that. And I mentioned that the biblical words for fear have two main connotations. The fear of God in the sense of being afraid of God. That's the fear that comes upon man when man has sinned, because it is a fearful or a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God, Hebrews 10:31. And given the fact of sin, the fear or of terror is a legitimate fear sometimes. The other connotation of fear is the sense of reverence or respect or awe. In Leviticus 19:3, children are commanded to fear their parents. Well, you wouldn't be in fear of them most of the time, but I can remember times when I was in terror of my dad because I needed to be. 1 Peter 3, verse 2 may be understood as telling wives to fear their husband. This would be respect. In both cases, we have the fear of respect rather than terror there in ordinary cases. But circumstance may change our fear from one sense to the other. Let me give you an imperfect illustration of that. If I go into Walmart and I make a purchase, and on the way out the door of Walmart I encounter a police officer, I'm not afraid of him. I respect his office. I fear in that sense, but I may greet him. I may hold the door open for him as I go out and he goes in. I'm not anxious to get away from that police officer because I've got no reason to be. But if I go into Walmart and rob the cashier, and on my way out the door, I encounter that same police officer, then I'm going to be in abject terror. I want to get away from him right now. Well, what changed from the first scenario to the second? The police officer hasn't changed. He may not even know what I've done yet in the second scenario. But I have a guilty knowledge, and I know that he's about to find out what I've done. Peter, in talking about our relationship, says, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God. Honor the king, 1 Peter 2:17. Well, I feared the police officer in the first scenario in the sense of respect. Paul, in talking about our relationship to civil government, says, if you do that which is evil, be afraid. And that was the second scenario when I robbed the cashier. Why be afraid? Because he beareth not the sword in vain, Romans chapter 13, verse 4. He is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So in relation to God, his fearsome and awesome infinity overwhelms us with a sense of awe at the very thought of him. We're overwhelmed with our smallness and our weakness in the presence of an omnipotent and omnipresent God. We recognize the infinite distance between God and us. Even angelic beings cover their faces in God's presence and cry out, holy, 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 Isaiah 6, verses 2 and 3. Jeremiah said, there is none like thee, O God, who would not fear thee, O King of the nations. Indeed, it is thy due. Jeremiah 10, verses 6 and 7. So the fear of God is maybe the most essential of human attitudes. It may not be the most important of human attitudes. Love of God, as we have on the screen, is very important too. But the fear may well come before that. Jesus teaches us to love God in Matthew 22:37, where he quotes from Deuteronomy and says that this is the first and great commandment. But the fear of God is foundational to that. It's the beginning of knowledge and wisdom, as we have in the first chapter of Proverbs. I'm not convinced we'll ever love God as we should without fearing him as we should, in the sense of reverencing him and being in terror of him when we need to be. The fear of God is the key to life, and the Proverbs state this over and over again. The fear of God is the key to peace and well-being. Ecclesiastes 8, verse 12 says, it will be well with those who fear God. Proverbs 15, verse 16, better a little with the fear of the Lord than treasure and turmoil without it. Fear of God is the determinative attitude of the heart. Fear of God is the characteristic mark of God's people. They are God-fearing people, like Abraham, Job, and Cornelius in the New Testament. The ungodly are devoid of the fear of God. There is no fear of God before their eyes, as Paul said in Romans 3:18. So though reverential fear ought to be our natural response to our Creator, it's not going to occur automatically without exception, and therefore we must be commanded to fear God. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, Philippians 2, verse 12. Now that trembling doesn't always have to mean terror. It can mean this reverence, but an awe that's reverential enough to induce trembling seems beyond what is commonly meant by reverential awe. It's not that we should be trembling all the time. God doesn't want that. We tremble when we know we're guilty of something. Is it possible for a God-fearing person today to be filled only with reverential awe, with never any mixture of terror and dread of God? Probably not. We ought to have that second when we need to. But ideally, God does not want us to be terrified of Him. We have lots of admonition where God was in somebody's presence and said, fear not. But since we have a continuing problem with sin, and the Lord's apostle says, if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, then we need to keep that part in mind too. Behold, therefore, the goodness and the severity of God, as Paul said in Romans 11:33. On them which fell, severity, but toward thee, goodness, if you continue in His goodness. Otherwise, thou also shall be cut off, Romans 11:22. So there is this tension in humanity subject to sin. The Apostle John spent years with Jesus. He walked with Him, talked with Him, ate with Him, worked with Him, lived in the same rooms with Him as they traveled. The Apostle John was in this inner circle with Peter and James. And of all the apostles, he was the disciple whom Jesus loved in a special way. But when he turned around on the Isle of Patmos and saw the glorified Christ, John didn't say, well, how you been, old buddy? Great to see you. What was John's response? When I saw Him, I fell at His feet as dead. If that was the response of the Lord's apostle, it better be our response too. Yes, the Lord touched him and said, fear not. Here's what I want you to do for me. But this is the same Lord that we need to be afraid of at times. We ought to be perpetually amazed that the mighty holy God has anything to do with us at all, because we sure don't deserve it. If we want to have 20/20 vision on the fear of God, we need to look at Exodus chapter 20, verse 20. This verse contains the word fear twice in an interesting juxtaposition of ideas. It's the children of Israel had delighted in the mercy of God. They had come out singing from the Red Sea. They had followed the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of cloud by day. But now they were called on to face God Himself at Mount Sinai. Behind all the superficial aspects of their life, they were called on to get at the heart of life. God has pronounced the Ten Commandments, and He did it with thunder and lightning and trumpeting and smoking. And the people recoiled. They were afraid. And they moved away from the foot of the mountain in Exodus chapter 19, verse 17. They moved to a place afar off in Exodus 20, verse 18. And they pled with Moses to serve as their mediator because they were afraid God was going to kill them. Let not God speak with us, lest we die. So they hid behind a man, Moses, to keep away from God. And in Exodus 20, verse 20, for our 20/20 vision, we go there. Moses said to the people, fear not, for God is come to prove you, that His fear may be before your faces, that you sin not. Exodus 20, verse 20. Fear not, because God is trying to get you to fear Him. What? This is an attempt to remove one kind of fear and instill the other kind. Do not fear with a fear such as brings consternation and produces nothing but terror. Fear with that fear which reverence and affection inspire, that you sin not. God is testing His people there to reveal whether they will obey Him, to produce people who fear God in such a way that they don't sin because of their fear, their reverence of God. So that fear was a test at Mount Sinai, and probably a test for us today. It's modeled by Isaiah, who said, "Woe is me, for I am undone." But then he said, "Here am I, Lord, send me." It's not a fear so as to draw back, it's a fear so as not to sin. Don't let your religion satisfy itself with anything less than God. Don't hide behind the superficialities. Insist on having your soul get at God and hear His voice. Samuel said, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth." So at Sinai, we have man fearing his native element, really. Man came from God, he ought to be able to be comfortable around God. Man was made to talk with God. So this was like a fish saying, "Don't throw me in the water because I might drown." What? That's your element. You belong in the water. Don't avoid God. Seek God. But as the people drew back, Moses drew near to God. Did Moses fear God? You bet Moses feared God. So terrible was the sight that Moses said, "I exceedingly fear and quake," the New Testament tells us. But the display which drove the people off attracted Moses. He even went into the thick darkness. Afraid of God's wrath, Moses drew near, because where God was, he wanted to be. So the divine presence is both attractive and repellent, depending on us. One man said to Jesus, "Lord, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest." But there were also those who besought him that he would depart out of their coast. God is love and God is power, and wherever he is, he exhibits both of those qualities. The divine presence at once attracts and repels, at once charms and frightens. The Israelites, invited to draw near to God, declined that offer. But Moses, given the same invitation and given a witness and being a witness to the same sights and sounds, he drew near. The same manifestations that repelled the people attracted Moses. The demons who have no love believe and tremble. Many who believe in God and have greatly sinned maybe can't help seeing God mainly as a consuming fire. Sinful Adam fled and hid after hearing God's voice in the garden. Whenever we consider the judgment of God on sin, it's impossible not to tremble with terror. But we must not fear only with the fear that has torment. The fear of the Lord is clean. The mere terror of the Lord drove man from God rather than bringing man to God. These people who were so in terror of God were within 40 days dancing around the golden calf. So being in terror of God did not keep them from doing that. But where love increases, then fear changes its character. The fear, the dread diminishes and the awe increases. Love draws us toward God and rejoices that we can go boldly into the throne of grace. But even though we in Christ are completely forgiven and are not under condemnation, it's appropriate for terror to strike our hearts at the merest thought of falling or falling away. So the Apostle Paul says, "Be not high-minded, but fear." A reverence of God's majesty, a dread of his displeasure, and an obedient regard of his authority over us. This fear will make us circumspect in our walking. Grateful love should be our primary motive for serving God. But that does not altogether exclude fear as an incentive for avoiding sin and doing good. One who stands in awe of God is going to stand in awe of his commandments. And if we get our fear of God right, it goes a long way toward a right life. I'll just use one more illustration and then we'll go on to the next point. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole of man, or the whole duty of man, Ecclesiastes 12:13. We should be perfecting holiness in the fear of God, 2 Corinthians 7:1, and conducting ourselves in fear during our time on the earth, 1 Peter 1:17. So you and I are like a lineman working high on a telephone pole. We're working close to a wire that's carrying enough electricity to kill us. We know that if we touch it, we die. So we have to pay close attention every moment, but if we're protected, then we don't need to be shaking in terror all day long either. We reverence God all the time. We should shake in terror when we are even considering doing wrong or when we have done wrong, and we should make that right as soon as possible. The fear of God in us is that which reflects our comprehension of who and what God is. And who and what God is will tolerate nothing less than total commitment to Him. So the fear of God is an attitude that must find expression in open praise of God. We acknowledge his greatness, and we try to help others do the same thing. Let's go on to the next point here, which is obedience of God. Goes right along. All these things go together. They are not separate and apart from one another. They're all part of one package. Where love and obedience exist, where love and reverence exist, then obedience is going to be cheerfully given. God's faithful people were known by two characteristics. They were called them that love him and keep his commandments. We hear that over and over again. Them that love him and keep his commandments. And if you love me, you will keep my commandments. John 14, verse 15. Words have to be supported by actions. Attitudes have to be supported by behavior. Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? Luke 6:46. You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. John 15, verse 14. Both the Father and the Son declare their right to require submission to their will as revealed in commandments. This response is at the very heart of that covenant relationship we talked about during the class time. The future was going to depend hugely on the decisions that the people made, and God could not control those decisions because he'd given the people free will. One more under the attitude of gratitude, and that is the worship of God. Love is the stimulus to worship. Reverence is the attitude of worship. Obedience is the requirement of worship. God's love for man is the motive of his government, and man's love for God is the motive of his obedience. There's a real interesting similarity in the pattern of Moses' first address in the book of Deuteronomy and that of Paul's epistles. Paul made a habit in his letters of stating first facts and then exhorting his readers to an appropriate response in the light of the truths which he already had set forth. And therefore, one of Paul's favorite words in his epistles was the word therefore. We see it over and over again as a hinge in his books. After he's given us 11 chapters in the book of Romans telling us all about the theology and about the Jews and God's relationship to them, he then uses the word therefore in Romans 12:1. I beseech you, therefore, by the mercies of God. Therefore, on the basis of those first 11 chapters, now I beseech you, do this stuff in the rest of the book. The same thing in Galatians chapter 5, verse 1. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made you free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Based on what has been said in the first four chapters. See the same thing in the Ephesian letter, which falls naturally into two pieces. After the first three chapters, I therefore, Ephesians 4:1, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you are called. Because of the foregoing in every case, therefore, as God's children, you have an obligation of gratitude and duty. And Moses' address, his first address, follows a similar pattern. In Deuteronomy 1, 6 through 3:29, he reviewed what God has done, and then in chapter 4, verse 1, he says, therefore, just like the Apostle Paul 1,500 years later was going to say, therefore, hearken to what I teach you based on what I've already told you. He's preparing the ground for his message, and every because of divine goodness invites our therefore of grateful response. Chapters 1 through 3 in the book of Deuteronomy record incidents in Israel's history between the departure from Egypt and the arrival at the plains of Moab, which is the scene of Moses' addresses. And these incidents that Moses brings up here were really selected from a much larger body of material, because they were selected to fulfill a particular specific purpose. And the clue to that purpose is this word, therefore. The incidents selected illustrate the ways of God with his people, and they give reasons why they should respond to him in obedience and reverence and love. As I mentioned before, and as Paul mentioned too, there's a lot of repetition in the Bible, and specifically there's a lot of repetition in Deuteronomy. In fact, reading the book of Deuteronomy, and I hope you have read it recently, it's like being on a broad beach and those long waves keep flowing in, and then they will withdraw, and then they'll flow in again. The major themes in Deuteronomy are stated and restated, and we're trying not to be as repetitive as Moses, but it's hard not to be because of the nature of this material. There's no theme in the book of Deuteronomy that receives more attention than God's strong, benevolent government toward his people. God had a purpose for these people. These people were ready to be satisfied with just a partial conquest of the land that God was giving them because of their unbelief in God's promises that they were depriving themselves. You know, our evaluation of God's goodness to us should rest not only on what we have received from Him, but also on what He is willing to give us if we obey Him better. God's leadership of His people was exercised with the tenderness of a parent toward a child and with the farsightedness of a general who always thinks ahead and who always provides for the needs of his troops. After Jethro's suggestion that there be a system of community government where Moses didn't have to do everything every day all the time, but you'd have these other people working underneath Moses to handle the things that Moses didn't need to be handling and leave the harder stuff for Moses so that he doesn't just kill himself trying to do his job. God does not condone every action of temporal powers, obviously, but He does endorse the principle of lawful authority in Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2. And Moses set a great example of delegation of responsibility to other people by assigning these other people to do what his father-in-law Jethro suggested. These people would be the instruments of God's justice because Moses had appointed them to do this work. God's government also included judicial powers. The people were not only to see judgments on idolatrous nations, but they would be the instruments of God's justice on idolatrous nations. The tendency of God's people, though, was to think that since we're the people of God, we're going to be dealt with more leniently. And Moses said, never make that mistake. Never say it can't happen to us. It happens to the other nations, but it can't happen to us. Because remember, it already happened to your fathers. And you've already shared in the consequences of their sin. And God won't spare you if you depart from His will. The main problem really was that they didn't believe God. And the Hebrew letter points that out. To whom swear he that they should not enter into his rest, but them that believe not. Hebrews 3:13. Nothing is more grievous in the sight of God than unbelief. Unbelief repudiates the very character of God. Unbelief implies that God is not to be trusted. Some of the tribes that stood in the way of these people were to be spared. Others of them were to be exterminated based on God's decisions. We should, though, recognize the unspeakable depravity of the nations which were to be totally destroyed. Their practices involved the vilest immoralities. This is looked at a little bit in chapter 9, verses 4 and 5. The extent to which Israel failed to press the conquest of Canaan and therefore permitted the inhabitants to remain, God's people at doing that were creating the conditions which led to their own apostasy and their consequent setting aside as the people of God. Using himself as an example, Moses told these people how he himself had prayed that he might be able to enter the promised land. And he talked to God about that so much that eventually God said, don't even talk to me about that anymore. Speak no more to me of this matter. I've made my decision and it's not going to change. Why did this happen? It happened because Moses had gotten so aggravated with the people that he forgot that he really was acting as God's representative. God's reputation was in stake at the way Moses was acting. God said, Moses, you didn't believe me and you didn't sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel. That was back in Numbers chapter 20. So Moses is setting before the people the goodness and the severity of God. Divine favor, freely bestowed, expected in return, belief, obedience, reverence, and love. Conformity to God's will was to be stimulated by gratitude. No word was to be added or subtracted from the commandments of God. Moses talks about an incident that's recorded back in Numbers 25, which we mentioned during the class time, when through the cunning of Balaam, many Israelites were seduced into idolatrous immoralities. A lot of them died, but not all of them did. And Moses said, you who did cleave to the Lord are alive, every one of you, this day. And then he says, take heed lest you forget. And this was a critically important thing. God forbade any attempt to express his likeness in wood or stone. They were not to even attempt to represent the Lord in a physical manner. To do so would have been to try to contain God or to limit God. And God could not stand that. It would have been to lose the concept of God's transcendence and his infinitude. God is so much greater than any attempt to represent him. So the only manner in which God could be represented by the people was by means of language. They could talk about God all the time. They were encouraged to talk about God and His commandments all the time. But when you used an image, you externalized and formalized the object of worship, and you detracted from the true response of love. And that led to the jealousy of God. False forms of worship had consequences not only immediately, but for future generations as well. Because if you were using false forms of worship, children and grandchildren would not be instructed properly in God's will. So making an idol had unending repercussions. And to preserve the distinctiveness of the Israelite monotheism, Israel alone among her Near Eastern neighbors refused to employ images. Every other nation, we've dug them up out of the ground. Every other nation used images. From the tombs of ancient Egypt, for example, we have discovered hundreds of tons, and I mean hundreds and I mean tons, of mummified cats and dogs and crocodiles and bulls and other animals, all of which were objects of worship for these people. You mummified a cat so you could keep it around so you could worship it. The major thrust of the book of Deuteronomy was to warn Israel against serving other gods. Moses' prophetic gift enabled him to know that Israel would yield to pagan enticements and forsake Jehovah for the sake of the nations, to be sent into the Babylonian captivity and to return from Babylon purged from idols. In the furnace of the Babylonian captivity, the idolatry was burnt right out of the Jewish nation. Jesus in his day accused the Jews of a lot of crimes, but he never once accused them of idolatry because they got rid of that in the Babylonian captivity and did not go back to it. And God still loved them after everything. Unlovely, but not unloved. That's the story of every redeemed person on this earth. God did not choose Israel or us to be His pampered favorites, but to be the instruments of His purpose. And I'm going to close by using just one last illustration here. You and I, as we serve God, are kind of like a bird dog. I don't know if you know what I mean by a bird dog, but you hunters definitely know what I'm talking about. It's been my privilege on numerous occasions in the past to hunt with a bird dog. The prowess of a bird dog as a hunter is developed by rigid training. The skills that a bird dog has deteriorate rapidly with disuse. And in many ways, a bird dog is a favored animal. It's well fed, it's cared for, but its purpose is service, and that's the point. You need that dog to do what it's supposed to do when it's supposed to do it, and when it doesn't, it's very frustrating to you as a hunter. And Israel was like that, and we're like that. God was trying to produce a channel through which His grace could flow to the whole world. And He did succeed, but the people made it much more difficult than it should have been. And God has chosen us, you and me, for similar purposes. Deuteronomy 1:6 through 4:49 has the same construction as Paul in his speech at Antioch of Pisidia in Acts chapter 13, verses 14 through 41. There's a historical review, followed by application and exhortation. And the therefore is in Acts 13, verse 38. And Paul shows his indebtedness to Deuteronomy there by actually quoting from Deuteronomy. For 40 years, as a nursing father, he bore with them in the wilderness. That's very much like Deuteronomy 1:31, especially as we have it in the Septuagint. And by Paul's time, of course, he was able to carry the story on much further than Moses did in his time. And in our time, we've come all the way to 2,000 years after Christ. The ultimate purpose of Moses in Deuteronomy was to give the Israelites guidelines for Godward and manward relationships after the settlement in Canaan. And Sam has read for us the substantial part of those guidelines in the 5th chapter. The Sinaitic covenant was based on what God had already done. The Ten Commandments showed the way in which man's love for God and his fellow man must be given expression. The law was legally binding, yes, but it was also a representative of God's love, and it called for a response of love. And today, based on all these Old Testament foundations, we have the law of love, the principle of love that we follow as we follow Jesus Christ. If you are outside of Jesus Christ today and would come to him in simple trusting faith, believing that he is who he claimed he was and following after those principles that we have observed from the book of Deuteronomy, if you would come to the Lord in simple trusting faith, repenting of your sins, confessing him, and would be immersed in water for the remission of your sins, we want to help you with that today. Or if you have anything else to bring before the assembled brethren, let us know how we can assist you by coming to the front as we stand together and sing one more song together.